end.
Hello there. Welcome. Today is Wednesday, August 2nd. This is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, a new report claims that President Trump dictated a false statement on his son's behalf on a meeting about with a Russian attorney.
Now, if you want to talk about the person who's really in hot water here, it's less the president and more his lawyer.
The crisis in Venezuela intensifies with the arrests of opposition leaders. The U.S. is weighing its options on the threat of North Korea. And also ahead, a Russian-born record producer joining forces with an English singer-songwriter. It's all on today's International Edition. The White House Tuesday said President Trump took part in the drafting of a statement issued in his son's name last month about a meeting that Donald Trump Jr. and other Trump campaign officials had with a Russian attorney. However, Trump's spokeswoman, Sarah Huckabee Sanders, told reporters Tuesday that the president didn't dictate the content of the statement, which within days turned out to be misleading.
The president weighed in as any father would based on the limited information that he had. This is all discussion, frankly, of no consequence. There was no follow-up. It was disclosed to the proper parties, which is how the New York Times found out about it to begin with.
Well, within a few days of the media scrutiny, the younger Trump released a chain of emails disclosing that the Trump team actually met with a group of Russians about so-called opposition research or negative information the Russians claim to have gathered about Trump's opponent, Democrat Hillary Clinton. Joining me now to discuss, criminal defense attorney James Goodnow. So what do you make of this latest revelation?
My first reaction from a legal perspective is this is another paper cut for Donald Trump. It's another example of the truth not coming out until it has to. The hand isn't played until you have reporting from the New York Times, or in this case, the Washington Post, that essentially catches the White House in what really amounts to inaccurate information or lies, at least coming from Jay Sekulow, Donald Trump's personal lawyer. And we see this pattern emerging. My view is this particular case, in some ways, is not going to be the straw that breaks the camel's back. You're not going to see this revelation changing the game in any meaningful way. If you take a 30,000-foot view, let's look at what we know here. If you accept the Washington Post reporting, Donald Trump misled America. That's a news flash here. That's not anything new, at least according to most people. We've seen day after day, you wake up and there's another example of a statement coming out of the White House that's not truthful. Where this is damaging legally to Donald Trump, potentially, though, is it is inviting Special Counsel Bob Mueller into this orbit, into the world of the people who were involved in this on Air Force One coming back from Germany. And if you're having a defensive posture like the White House is right now, the last thing you want is for people to come in and start poking their noses around and asking questions, because it may not be about this statement from Don Jr., but it could be a question about something else that ends up being a problem for Donald Trump.
What kind of legal problem could this pose?
I don't think this is an attempt to obstruct justice based on what we know right now. I think the legal problem isn't going to be about Daddy coming in and trying to write this statement. The problem could be something that we're just unaware of. When you have lawyers that would be under special counsel Bob Mueller coming in and really doing an investigation and talking to people that they wouldn't otherwise talk to, there could be other evidence, other emails, other situations that are connected to this or not that could come to light. So this is really a strategic error on the part of the White House in not getting this statement out. We know that when Don Jr. finally revealed all of these emails, when the New York Times was about to release them online, he said he was interested in full transparency, and that's why he was giving them to the public. Well, we then find out yet again that that actually wasn't full transparency, because we didn't know that Donald Trump was involved. Now, if you want to talk about the person who's really in hot water here, it's less the president and more his lawyer, Jay Sekulow. Hmm. He went on TV time and again, and he said categorically that the president was uninvolved in the drafting of this statement. That's just not true. And as a lawyer, that's a problem because you have to draw a sharp distinction between a typical surrogate who can go out and say anything, and while it may be ethically inappropriate, there's no governing law saying that you can't lie to the public. Not true with lawyers. Lawyers take an oath. They have to not only uphold the law, but they have to speak truth. And that's in the court of law, and that's also to the public. That's part of our ethical obligation to maintain our license to practice. So when Jay Sekulow made those comments, they were wrong, and he had a duty under the ethics rules that govern lawyers to correct those. He didn't do that. So I would not want to be Jay Sekulow today.
Do you think it's possible that he was going by what his client, President Trump, told him, and so he thought at the time he was telling the truth?
That certainly is a possibility, and the ethics rules deal with that situation. If you find out that a client has lied to you, you have to, one, instruct the client not to do it, and two, take remedial actions to fix it. We know that Jay Sekulow didn't do that. It was only after this story came out that he issued a cryptic statement saying, basically, this isn't pertinent to anything. So that's hardly correcting the record. So right now, Jay Sekulow, a lawyer himself, may need a lawyer to defend himself against the potential bar investigation.
That's Attorney James Goodnow. We appreciate your perspective. Here are some of the stories we are following at voanews.com. U.S. lawmakers demand justice. The Justice Department release new crime reduction policies. A U.S. sailor is missing in the South China Sea. Refugee arrivals to the U.S. plummet to the lowest level in a decade. And Somalia will open its first journalism school in 26 years. Find expanded coverage of these stories and more at voanews.com. And on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. The White House said Tuesday it is holding Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro personally responsible for the safety of two opposition leaders seized by police in the middle of the night. Twitter videos show intelligence agents dragging the men out of their homes and shoving them into cars. The two are under house arrest for previous opposition activities. U.S. State Department spokeswoman Heather Nauert reacted to the development.
Their arrest comes 2 days after the Maduro regime's illegitimate election for a constitutional assembly, which provoked even more violence in that country on the streets, with more than 10 people killed in that alone. The United States is concerned about grave human rights abuses.
VOA's Victor Beatty asked Professor Jennifer McCoy with Georgia State University for her perspective on what these arrests mean.
The justification given was that they had broken or violated the provisions for their house arrest, which is what they had been released to, house arrest, and because they had spoken out publicly and urged the protest to continue. But what I think it means is that the government is escalating the conflict and is taking a confrontational stance since the election on Sunday, rather than a conciliatory stance. And so it certainly raises the stakes, raises the chances for greater conflict and clashes, and follows what President Maduro said the night of the election, Sunday night, after the results were announced, that he wanted to lift the immunity of parliamentarians, and that, you know, indicates the possibility of them being charged and jailed, and that there would be, you know, further arrests.
Is there any solution that you see, and what is the strategy of the opposition going forward?
Well, one thing that happened today is that two deputies in the existing legislature called the National Assembly, who were in the government political bloc in the National Assembly, have left that as a critique to the vote on Sunday and the government's action. And so will have separated themselves from that bloc. And there have been some other defections, let's say, from former Chavistas who are also critical of what the government has been doing. So if a group of dissident Chavistas grows, that provides sort of a third or a middle ground. If they unite with the opposition, then that isolates the government further, along with the international isolation that seems to be growing. And so with those two tendencies, we may see eventually a willingness for real talks to begin.
I saw one media report suggesting all eyes are on the Venezuelan military, too.
Yes, of course, the military in most Latin American countries has traditionally held a kind of a position of arbiter and can either continue to support or withdraw its support for any government. So far, this military has certainly supported the Maduro government, and it's difficult to predict if there will be factions within it. There have been a few officers and troops leaving it or coming out criticizing, a few that have left the country as well, and some who have been imprisoned. But so far, there's not been, you know, a huge crack in the military. That's always a possibility.
Are we looking at growing street violence as the only recourse for those opposed to the government?
Well, I'm afraid that with the closing of political space, with the elections no longer an option, at least in the near future, and with protests being repressed and dissent resulting in prison, that people may feel, some may feel, that there's no other recourse except to take up arms. So that's the greatest danger, of course.
This looks like a big political gamble for Mr. Maduro. What is his end game? What is his point?
Well, I think his end game has been to stay in power and to protect the gains that the revolution has provided to the supporters of the revolution, and possibly also to protect themselves from prosecution.
What do you see the outcome being?
It's difficult to predict. I think eventually there will have to be some kind of negotiation. Hopefully there would be some kind of negotiations to transit out of the current stalemate, because the economy continues in a free fall and economic pressures will continue. The social and humanitarian pressures and crisis will continue, so that eventually something will have to give.
That's Jennifer McCoy, professor at Georgia State University. Well, America's top envoy is sending a message to North Korea that we're not your enemy, while the White House continues to assert that all options remain on the table to halt Pyongyang's ballistic missile and nuclear weapons programs. Now, Secretary of State Rex Tillerson, during a rare appearance at a State Department media briefing Tuesday, said despite North Korea's unacceptable threat to the U.S., it is the hope that there will be dialogue at some point.
China has ways that they can put pressure on and influence the North Korean regime because of this significant economic relationship that no one else has. We've been very clear with the Chinese. We certainly don't blame the Chinese for the situation in North Korea. Only the North Koreans are to blame for this situation. But we do believe China has a special and unique relationship because of this significant economic activity to influence the North Korean regime in ways that no one else can.
But he admitted the options on how to deal with the situation are limited. Patience is growing thin, however, among some U.S. lawmakers. The talk of the possibility, though, of a first military strike on North Korea is alarming some analysts, who warn it would result in millions of casualties and trillions of dollars in economic damage. You're listening to International Edition on VOA.
Hello, sports fans. This is Sonny Young of the Sunny Side of Sports. For detailed information about your favorite sports, visit our website, voaafrica.com. And if you want to chat with me and sports fans in Africa and all over the world, visit my Sunny Side of Sports Facebook page. There, the sports talk never stops. So come on, join the action with the Sunny Side of Sports.
Hi, this is Victor Beatty, managing editor of VOA News. Tune in to the Voice of America's newscasts every hour on the top of each hour, 24/7. Listen to our news and correspondent reports from around the world. VOA is your trusted source for news and information.
VOA's International Edition continues now with a story about American entrepreneurship. Being a tutor is not easy, and many teachers here in the U.S. are not allowed to coach students in school systems where they work. Often the families that need the extra help for their kids aren't able to find the help that they need. But with U.S. schools becoming more and more crowded, tutoring is something parents are seeking out. And a new invention is helping tutors to be able to do that. Joining me now is Megan O'Connor, who invented Clark, a virtual assistant that assists the emerging freelance educators like tutors and homeschoolers who don't serve the classroom. Megan, what exactly is this?
So the idea is when you work as something like a tutor, you're running a business and you're an educator. And those are two tall stacks. We do the business portion of that.
How did you go about coming up with something like this?
So I worked in education for a long time. I've done international education, a lot of different things in ed tech. But quite honestly, the lens by which I came to build Clark was my mom. She's a public school teacher in San Jose, California, and she's a single mom. So she always tutored as well. That was her side job while raising my brother and I. And in my adult life, I went to help, right? You go at a certain point in your life, you start to become peers with your parents, and I helped her take a look at the tutoring business she was running on the side of being a full-time teacher and realized that there was a lot of friction, a lot of human friction involved in running her business. I went to try to solve some simple problems for my mom and ended up unlocking what ended up being the first iteration of Clark. And I saw there was a gap in the market for people like my mom who are small business owners and educators as their trade.
Anything more on how this thing works?
Yes. So what we do is help with the things that you need in order to make your focus around student progress. So that means handling all of your scheduling, doing all of your payments, being the virtual assistant to you in the million different things you need to do in terms of curriculum, grading, things like that with your students, but also corresponding with your clients. And then most importantly, what we do is we help you track student progress. So if you're going to be an educator and work specifically as a tutor, you need to show that kids are getting better over time. And that needs to be clear, simple reports and data that parents can see as well. Clark helps you do that and share that information across all the stakeholders involved in a kid's life, both parents, students, and their in-classroom teacher.
Fascinating. How did you think to come up with something like this in the first place? What inspired you to do it?
I'm really passionate about the fact that I wanted to help my mom, who was a tutor. But where I got the real meat of the idea from was I started as a personal assistant for a bunch of tutors and other people who work as homeschoolers or learning specialists. And as serving as a personal assistant, I was able to truly track, you know, what's hard about running that job. Where could someone help? Where could software help? And that's how I built the first part of the technology, is by being a pen and paper assistant myself.
Has your mother actually used it?
Oh my gosh, she is by far most vocal customer. She was one of our first. And the funny part is now when she does talk to customer service, she doesn't realize that I can see it as well.
Mm-hmm.
So it's pretty entertaining.
And I understand that you've also got some pretty impressive big names investing in this. So obviously you must be doing something right.
Yeah, I think that what investors are excited about is the fact that we're going about the tutoring market in a different way than any of our predecessors. So there's been quite a few matching platforms that have emerged, you know, for quite a few years in the tutoring space. There's also a lot of AI bot-like features that are being developed in tutoring as well. But we're firm believers that you're never going to be able to replace the educator, and that real live tutors are still the best way for kids who are falling behind or want to learn a new skill will actually learn. So we're the people to build the technology all around in-person learning. And I think by being a provider-facing, provider-first technology solution, investors thought, wow, this is the first time we've ever seen anything like that.
All right. Well, we appreciate your telling us all about it. Megan O'Connor, inventor of the Tutor's Helper app, Clark. Turning now to what's trending on social media. Andrew Palchevsky's here. Hey, it's been a busy week, I know for sure.
It has indeed been a busy week, and it's been a busy week out in San Francisco, where on Tuesday, the Global Internet Forum to Counter Terrorism had their first ever meeting. Now, this is an organization that we've talked about before. It's formed by Microsoft, Google, Facebook, and Twitter. And the idea is for these companies to come together and try to fight online extremism and online terrorism. So they met on Tuesday in San Francisco, and according to Facebook, some of the goals that they wanted to accomplish were to leverage their technologies to try to fight terrorism, try to share knowledge and information and best practices to combat extremism, and then also to try to beef up some of the funding and some of the research for these efforts. So they are trying to do that. They've also announced some additional tech companies will be joining their efforts, including a big name, Snapchat. So it's not just the big social networks. It's going to be some of these other companies that are emerging, the up-and-comers as well. But in addition to these tech companies that were in attendance, there were two big names that were drawing a lot of attention. Amber Rudd, who is the United Kingdom's Home Secretary, and Elaine Duke, who is the United States Acting Secretary of Homeland Security, because, of course, Secretary John Kelly is now the new White House Chief of Staff. So she is leading the Department of Homeland Security. Okay. So the fact that these two women were at this conference speaks volumes about how much social networks are being pressured by governments to fight extremism. It's another topic we've talked about before, that a lot of these governments in the U.S., EU, UK are all pushing for these tech companies to do more to fight extremism on their platforms.
Wow, very cool. Very cool for sure. Anything else happening?
Something else very cool, perhaps a little scary. Facebook has been working on a number of different projects, including some chatbots that are supposed to mimic and learn from human conversation. We've seen this happen before, where Microsoft introduced what they called Tay, which was supposed to be a Twitter account that learned from humans as they tweeted at Tay. And it very quickly turned into a racist troll because people were tweeting all kinds of nasty stuff at Tay and they had to shut it down. These chatbots at Facebook, rather than talking with humans, were trying to talk back and forth with each other. And what happened was they started to create their own language to communicate.
What?
And so Facebook had to shut them down.
That's bizarre.
It is. So instead, for example of this language, instead of saying, I want to buy four books or I want to buy an airline ticket, they would say, in the case of the books, book, 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 to symbolize four books. Instead of saying four books, they would say the word book. And so it kind of turned into this string of gibberish, but both of these chatbots understood what the other one was saying. So to the outward-facing person, to these researchers, they thought it was just gibberish, but these chatbots were able to actually talk back and forth. It is kind of creepy. Facebook says, though, it's an important step forward in understanding how this artificial intelligence can interact with humans. They want to eventually incorporate this into Facebook so that you can buy books and plane tickets and everything else by doing chatbots and talking to chatbots. There are companies that employ this now. A lot of companies, if you go online and ask for help with a purchase or information, you'll get a response from a chatbot. But Facebook's trying to make this more interactive and trying to use intelligence for these bots to actually learn from the people they're talking with.
All right. Crazy stuff. Thanks, Andrew. You can follow him on Twitter at APAL. We also invite you to follow the International Edition stream at VOA_IE. Well, a Russian-born record producer is joining forces with an English singer-songwriter in a new single. VOA's Border Crossings host Larry London joins International Edition's Sarah Williams with all the details.
It's another music producer who has the spotlight for International Edition. His name is Zed, or at least that's the name he chooses to use while in his profession. His real name is Anton Zaslovsky.
And if I can see why he used the name Zed.
If it sounds Russian, it's because it is. He was born in Russia. Didn't spend much time there, just a very, very short amount of time early in his life. His family moved to Germany, where he kind of identifies more as his home now. And so he's on tour right now. It's a tour that's called the Echoes Tour. His latest album, which came out 2 years ago, is called True Colors. And we're going to check out his latest work, which is a song that features a former One Direction member, Liam Payne. And the song is called Get Low.
So how is Zed's latest recording different than ones he's done previously?
Well, they all vary a little bit depending on the artist that he chooses to feature. And he's so creative and so flexible. And he's worked with so many different artists over the years, internationally as well. He produced a hit in Japan for Amuro Namie, who's a very big name in Japan music. But here in the U.S. most recently, he was on the charts for quite a few weeks with a song called Stay that features up-and-comer Alessia Cara from Canada. And he tends to work with artists. He worked with another girl group called Foxes a few years ago and got a Grammy with them for a hit called Clarity. And so most of his music starts off as mainstream pop, and then he does remixed versions. And like, for example, with the song Stay, he released an EP of 6 different versions of the song Stay. And that's all it had on the EP, 6 versions of that same song. And so now the new song is with Liam Payne. Liam has been very slow to get started on his solo career since One Direction took a break. Liam also enjoyed becoming a father this past year with his girlfriend, who is also a singer from a band called Girls Aloud. Her name is Cheryl Cole. And there are rumors that Liam and Cheryl have secretly wed. And the baby boy's name is Bear, by the way. That's the name they chose to name, Bear. But so in this particular song, it's Liam and Zedd and Get Low, which, you know, it's a danceable song. We don't know what the direction Zedd is going to take next, but what he's known for is the very heavy beat type music. You know, when you see Zedd in concert, he does nothing but, you know, beat on beat on beat on beat. And it's just him. I had a chance to interview him a couple years ago when he was here in D.C. for a show. And he stands there. He's got his light show all programmed into the computer. And then he just does mixing, beat on beat on beat. And the crowd goes crazy. It's like a rave party, and it's lots of beats and lots of loud EDM music.
I was wondering, maybe Zedd and Liam will go on the road.
That's always a possibility. You never know. There was a song that Zedd recorded a few years ago with Selena Gomez, and that was done at a time that there were reports the two of them were kind of romantically involved. But that was very short-lived. As I say, he's worked with so many artists, and he may take Liam on the road with him. He's on the road right now for the current Echoes tour. But and Liam isn't on that. But there's always a possibility with a new single. Sometimes what they do is they just play the track of that artist. Because if you are like Zedd and you record songs with multiple artists, you can't have 10. Well, I guess you could, but it wouldn't be economically feasible to have 10 superstar guests show up for one song. So, you know, he plays the audio track of that particular artist. Because Zedd doesn't sing. He mixes the music. So that's what he does. And the new song is called Get Low.
All right. Well, thanks a lot, Larry. That's Larry London. He's the host of VOA's Border Crossings.
And that does it for today's International Edition. Thanks for joining us. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a great day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United States strongly condemns North Korea's launch of an intercontinental ballistic missile, the second in the month of July, in blatant violation of multiple United Nations Security Council resolutions that reflect the will of the international community. The United States rejects the regime's claim that these tests and these weapons ensure North Korea's security. In reality, they have the opposite effect. By threatening the world, these weapons and tests further isolate North Korea, weaken its economy, and deprive its people. All nations should take a strong public stance against North Korea, said U.S. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson, by maintaining and strengthening U.N. sanctions to ensure North Korea will face consequences for its relentless pursuit of nuclear weapons and the means to deliver them. As the principal economic enablers of North Korea's nuclear weapon and ballistic missile development program, China and Russia bear unique and special responsibility for this growing threat to regional and global stability, he said. U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations Nikki Haley called on China to exercise its unique leverage over North Korea to compel a return to denuclearization negotiations. China must decide whether it is finally willing to take this vital step, she said. The time for talk is over. The danger the North Korean regime poses to international peace is now clear to all. In the meantime, the United States will take all necessary steps to ensure the security of the American homeland and protect its allies in the region. In that regard, just 2 days after the latest North Korea missile launch, the U.S. military tested the Terminal High Altitude Air Defense, or THAAD, anti-ballistic missile system in Alaska. The defense system successfully intercepted a ballistic missile fired by an Air Force plane over the Pacific Ocean. Authorities said the exercise was successful and will help the U.S. stay ahead of the evolving threat. The United States, said Secretary Tillerson, seeks the peaceful denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula and the end to belligerent actions by North Korea. As we and others have made clear, we will never accept a nuclear-armed North Korea nor abandon our commitment to allies and partners in the region.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.